First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. We're going to talk a little baseball today. On the line right now, Joe Sheehan from the Baseball Prospectus. Joe, how you doing?
Good, Bill. What's going on?
How you feeling about this baseball season through 5 weeks? 6 weeks? 5 weeks?
It'll be 6 weeks this weekend. Yeah, you know, it's a good storyline so far. I think parity's the big thing. I mean, there's no real great teams. There's no truly terrible teams. It's what we've been working for. They've been working towards for 15 years with, you know, the revenue sharing and luxury tax and stuff like that. Just a lot of parity.
That's not a good thing, though, is it?
I don't think it is. I think baseball's at its best when you've got some great teams at the top. Really great pennant races. Granted, the wild card takes away from that. You're never going to see a 78 Yankees Red Sox or a 93 Giants Braves. But I think the game's best when you can identify who the best teams are. And I don't think there's anything wrong with having really bad teams there. There are times that, you know, bad teams need to rebuild. So I'm not somebody who likes the NFL version of a sports league.
I'm not either. I do think, though, that there wouldn't be parity if the Yankees had perhaps spent it a little more wisely and done some things differently, because they're still spending almost as much money as they always did, aren't they?
Well, they're at about $180 million this year, and they're trying to lower the payroll. That's been Cashman's goal for a number of years now.
Yeah.
There's a lot of dead weight on the roster. I mean, the Damon contract's $13 million. Granted, he's playing well, but that's not a great investment.
Right.
Derek Jeter's, $19 million this year? He's not playing up to that. Obviously, the Alex Rodriguez money, a lot of money, Messina, Giambi, a lot of the dead money. So, you know, until those contracts, guys like Messina and Giambi come off the payroll, it's going to be hard for them to get it down too far.
Well, the other thing we're seeing is some of the basement teams have been in the basement so long that they've just been stockpiling all these guys. Now you look at a team like Tampa, and they're just loaded, but they should be loaded because they've been drafting in the top seven every year for, like, you know, 9-10 years, right?
Yeah, you look at the Devil Rays, and there's a momentum thing. If you draft in the top five long enough, you're going to have a good team. But that actually doesn't apply in Pittsburgh. Everywhere else it applies.
You're right.
But you look at the Devil Rays, and you PJ Upton and the pitchers they've got coming through, and it's just a product of drafting that high for that long. You're going to eventually be good.
They also did a really smart thing with signing Percival, who people were torn on fantasy-wise heading into the season. I loved him. I have him on both of my teams. I was just feeling it. I like the whole surgically scarred shoulder somehow miraculously healed. I was buying it for some reason. But it's so weird to watch them and have them have a decent closer coming in at the end of these games. I don't know if they've ever had a closer before.
Well, Al Reyes wasn't bad for them last year.
It wasn't bad.
You know, a guy like Jim Messier back about 10 years ago, the right-hander with the club foot, he pitched well for them. But this is the first fire-breathing closer they really had.
Yeah.
It is a great story. And you've seen this with a couple of guys now where Jarrett Wright comes to mind, where you just take a year off. Your arm is just so slagged. You take a year off, you come back, and you're healthy again. And we saw that with Percival. And I wonder if that's not a lesson for these guys like Rich Harden or Mark Pryor. Just take a year off, get yourself healthy, come back, and then you can be a star for the Devil Rays.
You don't like Rich Harden's game plan of pitching 50 innings a year and just repeatedly going on the DL?
Well, you know, you time the 50 innings right, you can make a lot of money. Who was it? About 15 years ago, Willie Blair was this journeyman guy. I remember he had like 50 good innings at the end of one season, got a four-year deal from the Diamondbacks. So you time the 50 innings right, you sure make a lot of money.
The pitching in the American League, which everybody thought was going to be abysmal, and then you look at the stats, and first of all, Cliff Lee is the new Sandy Koufax. I don't know how this happened. And then Ervin Santana is on pace to go 35-0 or something. I think this has really been one of the weirdest seasons I can ever remember. It's definitely in the top three for me.
In terms of guys coming out and these out of nowhere performances, now I'm gonna self check a little bit here. I was on Santana. I loved him coming out of last year. So many people were down on him. Command problems, the demotion, the home road splits. But in terms of raw stuff, he's in the top 10, 12 guys in the American League. And it's really great to see him get his command together. But I don't know if you saw Lee come and if you've got him on a fantasy league or not. I didn't see this coming or not. 39-2 strikeout-to-walk ratio.
It's insane.
That's ridiculous. And, you know, I picked on him last week. I got to write about him, got to talk about him. He hadn't faced anybody yet. He faced the A's, the Mariners, the Twins, and the Royals. And I think an all-star team of those lineups wouldn't actually be an above-average offense. But last night, you know, the Yankees are down, but, you know, he went after the Yankees, he threw basically got his fastball over at the start and just worked off of that. It was really something to see. And it reminded me of when CeCe Sabathia got it together a couple of years ago. Remember Sabathia used to have all these control problems? He was a high pitch, high walk guy.
Yeah.
And then suddenly stopped walking guys. That's what Lee reminds me of right now, where Sabathia changed his mechanics, started going to the plate more with less wasted motion. That's the guy Lee was last night. It's fantastic to see.
Well, and also Jake Westbrook got hurt, but I think he was another one of those guys that had been bouncing around for a little while who was starting to put it together. But I think what we're seeing maybe a little bit is that with these starting pitchers, you have to be even more patient than normal. Sometimes it just takes 4 or 5 years for some of these guys. And, you know, and then the other thing that we're seeing is it's such a Russian roulette with these rookie pitchers and these young guys. And the Red Sox have done reasonably well with Buchholz and Lester. But the Yankees, you know, they shot the bullet and it actually hit them with Hughes and Kennedy. So I just don't know what to make of baseball going in, not just this year, but these next 3-4 years, because it just seems like it's so much harder to predict, you know?
Like you're seeing the game change, I think, in front of our eyes. We're coming out. Certainly runs are down. I mean, if you go back to, you know, the 98 to 2002 period, offense is down a lot from that period, especially this season. There's been a big drop-off. And does that mean we're moving back to kind of an 80s set where you don't need to be a strikeout pitcher? Because right now, I mean, I was kind of looking at some of the stuff the other day, and the stuff that's up, it's not that there's a lot more strikeouts. It's not that there's a lot fewer walks. It's that when guys are hitting the ball, it's becoming an out, or it's not going for a double or a triple or a homer. You say, well, is that the baseball? Is that a different approach? Is that pitchers getting better? There's something they're doing. But the key is that pitchers don't have to strike everybody out anymore. Because you remember for years, I mean, everybody was hitting home runs. So you didn't want to work inside. You didn't want to pitch to contact. And if that's going to change, the whole game changes from that point. If you can pitch to contact again, now you're talking about 1980s baseball.
Well, I was waiting and waiting and waiting for you to say it. You didn't say it, but the steroids thing, I think that's been kind of the sleeping giant of this whole season. You're watching these guys are cranking shots, and they're going to the warning track or just their dead fly balls versus 3 years ago they're going out.
Well, here's my – okay. You put that out there, but let me run at this from a different direction.
Okay.
We saw the Mitchell report. We saw all the names in the Mitchell report. We saw a lot of pitchers – come out in the last couple of years. A lot of the pitchers have actually been guys who've been suspended.
Hmm.
We know that a lot of these guys picked up velocity, had 3 good years, and then fell apart. Now, I'm saying that what we know in terms of guys who've tested positive and guys who were named in the Mitchell report, there are a lot of pitchers involved there. So if steroids are an issue here, they're an issue on both sides of the ball. The other thing is that we've had all of these different landmarks along the way. There was the testing program in 2003, and then there were suspensions in 2004, and then there were bigger suspensions in 2006. And offense has pretty much kind of just bounced around the way it normally has. So I got a real problem to argue that, say, here in 2008, suddenly it's because there's no more steroids in the game. I think there's something else going on. I don't think you can point to any one reason at this point, and I think to point to steroids is a little too simplistic.
Interesting. Yeah, because I've seen some of these guys in the AL, and I won't name any names, but it's, you know, you can look at the stats and you see these guys hitting 220 with 2 homers, who are guys who have, you know, been in the 30s and homers, and it makes you wonder. And it seems to happen, not just this season, but it's happened last season, the year before, and it does seem like the game has gotten a little more athletic. And you see, like, more and more of these Jacoby Ellsbury types, or basically everybody in Arizona. And there's just less of the big boppers. Like, I wonder, I know there's always going to be a place for, like, the David Ortiz, Ryan Howard types, but it seems like there are less of them now, and there's more of these kind of multi-tool, hit 300 with 12 homers. And, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, one of the arguments that I've seen for, you know, there's that whole clutch of guys who are unemployed right now, Sosa, Bonds, Thomas was released. And there's an argument that one of the reasons those guys can't find jobs, that teams are trying to get away from the slow slugger types to get more to the athletic types. And, there's not a ton of evidence that it's that's the reason these 7 guys happen to be unemployed. But I do think teams are starting to say, okay, defense matters a little bit more. One of the misconceptions about stat heads is that, you know, we don't care about defense. And the thing is, we never could measure defense that well. But we always knew it was valuable. Now, we're getting better about being able to measure defensive performance. And I'd like to think that maybe is tying in where you say, okay, we know we've got a better grasp on how to quantify defense, and we can use that to evaluate individual players and team performance. You look at a team like Tampa Bay, And I know you were down there last year, and or was it 2 years ago you went to a Red Sox game?
Last year, it was depressing.
Yeah, and they're trying so hard. You really got to root for this organization. The big change they made last year, year over year, you look at them a year ago with B.J. Upton at second base and Johnny Gomes playing center field, and now you look at them, they moved Upton to center field, you know, 5 years later than he should have been moved, and they've upgraded the defense so much. They're a team that has taken defense and said, this is how we can become a lot better. So we focus on their pitching, Kazmir and Shields and Percival, but the upgrade in the defense is what's actually helping them prevent all those runs and maybe makes them a wild card contender.
So in the earlier part of this decade with Billy Beane and Moneyball and all that stuff, people started emphasizing OBP. And then there was a subtle shift where it seemed like people realized that the best value, because now everybody was valuing OBP, was defense. I think that the Red Sox were one of the first teams that did that, actually. So what do you think will be the next trend after the defense trend?
Well, one of the things that if you look at the acquisitions the A's made at one point, were trying to find guys who had trouble staying on the field. Maybe there was something that he said, guys who were unhealthy, who weren't healthy players, but when they could play, they were very good. That didn't seem to work out for them. I don't know that there's going to be a next tier. I mean, we've measured pitching, and we've measured offense, hitting, about as well as we can do. We've gotten to a point where we can actually measure the value of base running. And defense we're getting much better at. I don't know if there's necessarily a statistical marker to be had, you know, to another undervalued thing. I think the next thing is going to be health. And Will Carroll, who worked with a baseball respect, will talk your ear off about this. But the team that finds a way to keep its players the healthiest over a period of years. Because every time, you know, an $8 million player misses a month, okay, that's $1 million you've lost. That's $1 million in performance. I mean, if you can find a way to keep your players on the field, and that's twofold. One is acquiring guys who are going to stay on the field, which generally means you want to have younger players, guys who are healthier. And the other thing is when you have them, making sure you keep them in shape. You know one of the things the Red Sox do, Bill? I know that the Sox are near and dear to your heart.
Yes.
They do a thing called baseline testing. They get everybody together, and all the pitchers together in February, and they have them throw when they're fresh and healthy. And throughout the year, they get measured against that level. So this is how John Lester should throw when he's, you know, healthy and fresh. And when he gets too far away from that, they manage his workload. Maybe they'll skip a start. And it's different for individual guys. But what it means is they're constantly measuring fatigued guys against their healthy baseline. They always know how close their guys are to their breaking point. To me, that's one of the key differences in the Red Sox now, everybody else. The Red Sox are applying things like that. They're saying, okay, what tools can we use to make our team better? That, to me, is an edge that most teams have, keeping their guys healthy.
Well, we've seen that happen in the NBA, too, because the Suns, you know, their medical staff, I don't know what they're doing, but they've figured out a way to kind of rehab these guys that people thought might be done or might be 50-game-a-year guys. And that is, I wonder, like, all these people that are graduated from college in sports medicine, because they're just, like, coming out in droves. Like, you're right. That could be, like, the next wave. It's all these different cool ways to rejuvenate somebody's career. Like, I look at somebody like Howie Kendrick, who's on both of my fantasy teams, and this guy can pull a hammy and he's out for 5 weeks. Like, what are they doing with that guy?
Yeah, and he's had hand issues. I mean, you can get too caught up in this. I mean, J.D. Drew has a really bad rep. I know, one of your favorite guys.
Yeah.
But a lot of his injuries were fluke injuries. I mean, how can you get on a guy who just happened to, you know, his hand wasn't good enough to take a fastball? A lot of the injuries he had were situations like that where he got hit by pitches. But there are guys who are chronically had these chronic leg problems. Luis Castillo, you're an AL fantasy guy. He tortured you for years.
Yeah.
Guys who just can't stay on the field. They know they have the skills. If you keep those guys on the field 15-20% more, that has such a huge impact on your bottom line. I mean, you look at the Yankees right now. Instead of Alex Rodriguez and Jorge Posada, who are making, what, $41 million this year, they're playing Jose Molina and Morgan Ensberg, who are two of the worst players in the American League right now. We can quantify that. I'm not going to say you can't quantify that, but you're giving away value and cash at such a large, at such a fast rate. I mean, the Yankees might not make the postseason because they didn't have those two guys on the field for a month.
Explain VORP in 20 seconds.
How much better a guy is compared to freely available talent quantified in terms of runs.
Wow, that was like 4 seconds.
Yeah, I've been doing this a long time.
tell everyone how long Baseball Prospectus has been around and how it's evolved. And that, I mean, I want to talk about that, and I also wanted to talk about how baseball stats have kind of evolved to where people just called you geeks and they didn't understand OPS and all that stuff to now has become this accepted part of the game.
Well, now they call us geeks, but they understand OPS. So it works out. We started in 96. We put out the first book in April of 96. It was five of us, Gary Huckabee, Clay Davenport, Randy Giserly, Chris Carl, and myself. I sold 170 copies out of my bedroom. And this actually started, you know, years ago. Clay and Gary had been doing stuff on the early versions of the Internet, you know, for years, putting stuff out for free. And they decided they wanted to put it out as a book. I just happened to know Randy, who was involved, and I was just out of journalism school at USC. So I got involved, and we just kind of went from there.
When did you get on the Internet?
Let's see. I got my first email account in 91 or 92.
No, I'm talking about when did the baseball...
We launched the website... No, I'm sorry, Bill. We launched the website in August of 96. Now, this was... People were using, like, Mosaic.
Yeah.
And there were 43 people on the World Wide Web, but you needed to have, you know, a .com, so we registered the .com. We'd put up, like, an article or two a week. And honestly, Bill, until probably 2000, our main deal was the book. The book was how, you know, our product, and the website was just something we had to have. We'd get maybe an article a day up there, not even that. And I'd say in the early part of the 21st century, we kind of shifted over. We still do the book. We still do other books. But the website became more and more a central part of our business. We started doing work for ESPN.com. I tripped over ESPN News. I'm working with them for a while. In 2003, we went pay. So now it's $40 a year to read Baseball Prospectus. And since then, it's pretty much been more, that's our focus. Our focus is the website. And the books are the other stuff we do.
What was the tipping point for you guys where you realized, like, uh-oh, we're getting a foothold here. Something's happening.
Acceptance within the game. Billy Beane was really one of the first guys, and Billy Beane would be a guy to read all the abstracts through Sandy Alderson. And he was one of the first guys within the game to recognize what the guys like Keith Woolner and Clay Davenport could bring to the table. When Rob Nyer mentioned us at ESPN.com, and then subsequently we started writing for ESPN.com, that really enhanced our visibility, enhanced our credibility. So those were two key moments along the way.
And then when do you think you became, I don't want to say mainstream, but you are kind of mainstream at this point. I mean, you were the first of your kind.
Yeah, I mean, well, two things have happened. We've become more mainstream as we've come along. I mean, we're not the guys speaking some of the stuff that we put up on the website, some of the stuff we put in the early books. It's funny, but you look back on it and go, maybe we could have phrased that differently. Jokes about, you know, jello fights between some general manager and Janet Reno. But now it's like, you know, we've become more mainstream. We've brought in people who are more connected, guys like Will Carroll, guys like Kevin Goldstein. We've accepted viewpoints. I mean, Kevin is really not a stats guy per se. He's really more of a scouting and insider guy. And his material tends to reflect more of that mainstream viewpoint. But I think it blends well to what we do. At the same time, though, I mean, look at box scores in the newspaper now. Look at the discussions of baseball in places like Sports Illustrated, the Sporting News. Everybody remembers the Sporting News, right? Yeah, some of us. Some of us remember when it was good. I'm going to get in trouble for that, I know.
Yeah, probably.
You look at a game now, and now they have, you know, instead of average home runs RBI, there's OBP, or there's slugging. Or with pitchers, they'll look at stuff. I mean, you're not seeing VORP on every broadcast, but some of the basic concepts have really penetrated to a point where if you're a 15-year-old baseball fan now, you take OBP and slugging for granted. That wasn't the case when we were 15.
Yeah, it's true. I remember being in a fantasy league in the early 80s, and that we used batting average and homers, and you added them together, and those were the two categories.
Nice.
And so Harold Baines hit 320 with 15 homers, so he's a 335. And now I'm in a league where OBP and WHIP are two of the categories. And I just think, like, if I had traveled back in time and told myself this in 1982, the young kid would have had a heart attack. Like, OBP, what are you talking about? The other thing that's interesting is how it's kind of changed how we value these players, because I remember like Andre Dawson in the mid-80s thinking like this guy's one of the five best players in the league. But now when you look at his stats, yeah, he hit 290 and his on-base percentage is 308. You're like, was Andre Dawson even that good? Like, it's totally changed how I look at everybody that I grew up with.
Yeah, the value of not making outs, the value of OBP, I think is one of the key things. And it comes up all the time now. It comes up in Hall of Fame discussions. I think if not for this, you know, all this additional information that we know, or rethinking of what's valuable in terms of baseball, guys like Rice and Dawson would have been the Hall of Fame years ago. Now, they're both going to get there, but it's been a different discussion. I mean, you never heard in Hall of Fame discussions anybody's OBP get discussed. Well,
right.
Now it's discussed. I mean, I think that the game's better for it. I think there's one of the things that I get most angry about is people who think that somehow, you know, stat guys ruin the game or take the fun out of the game, love the game. All that stuff drives me nuts. I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting to know more about something you enjoy. And you can enjoy baseball in a million different ways. but you can't tell me that somebody's appreciation of it, because they like to know about the stats, makes them a lesser fan or detracts from somebody else's fanhood who doesn't.
Well, and it's also more logical, because what, as it turns out, what we valued in the 70s and 80s were wrong. Like, you know, we like somebody if Omar Moreno got 79 stolen bases, that was great, but we discounted the fact that he also got thrown out 40 times. Or somebody like, you know, on the 78 Red Sox, I think it was either Remy and Burleson or Burleson and Remy. I forget who was the 1-2, but both of those guys had like 290 and 300 on base percentages. We never thought anything of it.
Nope.
But it's much more logical to have somebody who gets on base a lot before the guys who hit for power. And for whatever reason, that took until the 90s for people to start to even, you know, consider that.
Yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, remember how weird it was when Brian Downing was leading off?
Yeah, I remember, but I remember them taking heat for that because he wasn't fast.
Yeah,
and same thing with Boggs.
Boggs was a fantastic leadoff hitter for the Sox. You got to remember too, though, we didn't invent the wheel here. Bill James didn't invent the wheel. Guys like Branch Rickey and Earnshaw Cook and guys like that were talking about it 40 years ago. Well, now almost 60 years ago. It's just that it was not really talked about outside of the game. There were smart people within the game who knew this stuff. But, you know, kind of got caught up in other things, and it wasn't until the 80s, really, with Bill James, that a lot of this stuff started to really take hold to where now it's just accepted. Now when a team leads off Alfonso Soriano, everybody goes, well, can't you do better than that?
Yeah.
And it's the team that's on the defensive, as opposed to, you know, the stat geeks.
I would also argue, from watching some of the old games that they show on ESPN Classic sometimes, I just think the way people play baseball have changed, because you watch those games back then, and the strike zone was humongous, and the players felt like they constantly had to swing at anything close because they were just going to strike out otherwise. So it wasn't like what we see now where you have this tight strike zone. You got guys bleeding counts, guys taking 45 seconds between pitches, and it's much more methodical now than it was. Before, it was almost like, hey, go up there and just swing. So I don't know how much that plays into it. Like maybe – you know, maybe Jim Rice, if he's in the game now, maybe he is in the 400s on base. I don't know.
Well, there's a number of things in play there. When you mentioned the size of the strike zone, that's actually the thing that gets me. People talk about the great pitchers of the 60s. Well, they were pitching on, you know, mounds that were built up 3 feet high, and the strike zone was basically your eyelashes to your ankles. I mean, Sandy Koufax was a great pitcher, but he also pitched in the greatest conditions of just about any pitcher in history. So it's hard to separate that. He's like the Todd Helton.
Well, and also a lot of day games, too, which was another huge thing.
Well, actually, they shifted more to night games in the 60s, and some of these parks weren't lit very well. I mean, if you're trying to hit Sandy Koufax on a tall mound with poor lighting, that's that's a tough job. So, you know, it's hard to separate guys from their conditions. But you talk about the 70s. You had the strike zone was definitely bigger then, but I think particularly vertically. So the pitches that, you know, like pretty much between the belly button and the letters that don't get called strikes anymore, those were strikes back then.
Yeah.
And not only did you not have, I mean, pitchers would just basically be able to throw strikes, but not everybody was a threat to go deep. There were like four guys in every lineup who could hurt you. And the other four to five guys were these, you know, Mark Belanger's an extreme example. But you talked about you guys like Remy and Burleson. Those guys would hit five homers a year.
Yep.
So you could throw fastballs to them, and they weren't going to knock it out of the park. Now, smaller strike zones are one thing, but everybody in every lineup is a threat to go deep. I mean, the worst regulars in the major leagues now, you know, will hit 5 to 10 homers a year, and the bad players tend to hit 15 to 20. You can't make mistakes, and it just goes. Now the cycle starts. Pitchers have to nibble more. They can't just come into everybody. So now the hitters are hitting in better counts. So now the power goes up. It's a cycle. Everything, all the conditions of the game have given us what we have now.
I don't mean to be one of those things were back better in the old days, guys, but I do think that baseball is a little less entertaining just to watch than it was. Like, you know, everybody thinks the Red Sox-Yankees is the best rivalry. Their games are excruciating.
Yeah.
I defy anybody to sit through a Red Sox-Yankees game and have a good time. 4.5 hours, you know, a minute between pitches, and every time they're on Sunday night at ESPN, and I'm on West Coast time, so it's like 8 o'clock, it's the fourth inning. It's just crazy. And, you know, I don't know what they have to do to speed it up, but I do feel like the way society is working now in general, like we multitask. Like I'm watching a baseball game, I'm online. Or I'm flipping between five things. And I do wonder, like how many people out there just actually sit down and watch a baseball game anymore from beginning to end.
I mean, I do it myself. I'm watching. I'll have that extra innings mix channel on. I'll have 8 games on at watch, and I'll flip from game to game. I mean, I love baseball, but the pace of it can be difficult. Now, the thing that I get is people compare it to football, and people who think football is better paced than baseball need to have their head examined.
Right.
It's just. I mean, let's be realistic about that. But sure, I mean, the game was paced differently, and I think that's what we see too. People complain about it. You and I grew up, you know, 70s, 80s. The guys who were writing about it remember the 60s and 70s when games would take 2 hours.
Yeah.
And you're just not going to go back to that. Nobody taught. I mean, there's a lot more commercial time than there used to be.
Yes.
I mean, and that's something that nobody ever really talks about. But that is, yeah, everybody complains about Nomar Garciaparra fidgeting or Rafael Betancourt taking 20 minutes between pitches. That stuff's a problem. But it's also a problem when you insert all this extra time. Or it's like the Yankee seventh inning stretch, which takes 25 minutes. Things like that. I mean, they add to the time of the game. But pace. People think about pace, though. It is more like counts. You know, at-bats take longer now. Innings take longer because there's more base runners. There are more pitching changes. Thank you, Tony La Russa. So everything is trended to make the games longer. You know, I just don't think there's any one right way of baseball. I like variety. I like one of the things about the 80s is that you had places like the Kingdom where everybody could hit, and then you had places like the Astrodome where nobody could hit. And I think it's great when you have a variety like that, where some days you're going to get a 12-11 game and some days you're going to get a 1-0 game. I think we're getting back to that now, where there's a little more variety in the game. It's my argument why I don't think soccer ever caught on, because there's no chance you're going to go to a soccer game and see a 7-6 game.
Yeah. My thing is it's a lot tougher to go to a game now because you know it's like a 5-hour commitment, whereas I don't know in the past that was always the case. Like, one of my favorite guys to see when I lived in Boston was Wakefield, because – with Wake, you knew the game was going to be 2.5 hours or less. I wasn't going to be crammed in some grandstand seat until 11 at night, you know, just wait with these endless pitching changes. Wake just comes out, and he's still one of my favorite pitchers to watch. And then you watch somebody like Betancourt, and I just feel like they have to come up with some sort of rule, at least for those guys. Don't you think?
Enforcing a clock rule in baseball, aside from the whole, well, there's no clock in baseball issue, it really gets complicated, because now the umpire has to call the pitch, and now time when the batter gets back, you know, the ball gets back to the pitcher, and what if the hitter stepped out, and what if the pitcher did this, and what if the fan, you know, there's so many other things that he has to worry about that I don't necessarily that's going to work. I think you've got to make it part of the culture. You know, it's got to be the part of the culture where, you know, get on the mound and throw the ball. I like watching Chin Ming Wong because he works fast.
Yeah.
Greg Maddux is one of my all-time favorite pitchers. He works fast. I love guys that get the ball and throw the ball. And, you know, then we looked at it, and there's really no difference in the defensive performance of teams behind a fast pitcher versus a slow pitcher. To the extent that you've looked at it, it's been looked at it, there's really no difference.
Well, because the old wives' tale was that there always was.
Yeah, and there's not. But the thing is, it makes for a better game. And I can't, I mean, as somebody who pitched, I was always a get-the-ball, throw-the-ball guy.
Yeah.
There's nothing that's going to happen between me getting the ball and me throwing it again that's going to change anything. Get in the box and let's go. And I don't understand the mindset of guys who don't want to approach it that way. I just want to get the ball, get the signal, and go. And there are guys who have a lot of success doing it that way. And I just, again, make it a part of the culture. Make it a part of the culture that if you're a hitter, you don't go take a six-minute walk, you know, every time you foul a ball off.
Well, when I was growing up, Fisk was really the only guy who took forever.
Hargrove.
Hey, well, on the Red Sox.
Oh.
Yeah, Hargrove was the human rain delay, but Fisk was the only guy on our team that, you know, it was just his at-bats took a long time, and it was kind of cute, but it was funny. We made fun of it, but nobody else on the team was like that. Yeah.
It's not cute if it's everybody. Like I said, I think people focus on the hitters too much. Oh, hitters step out of the box. They fiddle with the pitchers are just as bad. I was watching the other day, and I forget what reliever it was. It wasn't Percival. It was another Devil Rays reliever. Oh, that's going to cost me a dollar. Another Rays reliever. They walked back, stepped off the mound, took the throw back from the catcher, went around the mound, and came back up. They did this on every single pitch.
I see. I think the umpire should just have the right to just whistle him for a ball. Why are you doing a lap around the mound? That's not helping you.
Well, the problem, of course, is now you put the umpires in. Now you've made the hall monitors. And I got to say, if I'm an umpire, I don't want any part of that. The job's hard enough. If you're going to turn them into hall monitors, that really changes the nature of the relationship. I'm not a huge fan of the umpires in general, but I think that's a lot to put on them. Again, this is where I think it's got to be more a culture of the game. And this is what Bob Watson in the commissioner's office has worked towards. He's tried to make it part of the culture of the game. Will you try to put these rules in the minors? These 12-second rules and these pace rules, and you say, hey, look, this is what you're going to do, and hope that over a generation you create a generation of baseball players that plays the game that way. How much do you think is TV?
Well, what if you had an actual hall monitor? And it wasn't any of the umps. It was just some fifth guy.
The potential for abuse there. I mean, you see it all the time. I mean, let's take a situation like the other night in Detroit to go to basketball for a second.
Yeah.
You've got some theoretically neutral party with his finger on the button on the shot clock button, or a finger on the clock button. Well, the clock, quote-unquote, malfunctions, and the Pistons get 3 points they never should have had. So what if you get a hole monitor who has the ability to occasionally give a batter a 1-0 count?
First of all, it's never going to happen because baseball is historically slow to add anything to the game that is different, to make it different than it was in 1892.
Wait a minute. No, I disagree completely. If you look at the last 15 years,
yeah,
there's been radical changes in baseball structure. On the field, less so, but there's been radical changes.
I'm talking about on the field. Like, we still don't have instant replay to decide whether something was a home run
or not. That's got to happen. That's got to happen right now.
Like, we could sit in a room for 8 hours and not come up with one explanation why that can't happen.
Umpires basically have papal infallibility. That's what baseball has given them, and it's ridiculous. I mean, go back to, situations like the Doug Eddings thing. Or, huge calls. I mean, are we still waiting for Matt Holliday to touch home plate in that game last year?
Yeah.
There's got to be some way to get out of this notion of umpires being involved. Don't tell me about the human element. I don't want the human element. The humans that I want involved are the players.
And you know what's funny, though? In the playoff games, and they put the guys in the outfield, and those guys, like, routinely mess up the calls anyway. It's like, why? Just have them drink out there, because they're not going to make any impact at all.
I wrote about this last year. There was a call where they blew it. There was a left field umpire blew the call. Oh, no, what it was, the third base umpire ended up making it, and the left field umpire just kind of stood there. I'm saying, if they're not there to make that one call in a series that actually should they make, what's the point? Is it just that they get two extra guys to have a couple bucks and some good seats?
Yeah, I would use instant replay not only for homers, but for the line drives down the line.
Given how quickly you can get replay
and how
much dead time there is between plays, I think you can integrate it in baseball. I don't think you need it I don't know if I want to put every single play on, but there's got to be some subset of plays that are high impact plays that you say, we're gonna look at these twice. Again, you're talking about a game that has a lot of dead time. You're talking about a game where they put 15, 20 minutes of additional time worth of commercials over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
You can find time to do this.
And what's weird is that instead of adding the commercials, there's ways they could kind of advertise during the game. Like, I don't know what happened to the bullpen car. That, to me, they could just make it like NASCAR and have like 7 ads on it, and then that's an ad when the guy comes in.
Yeah, but they do that. In terms of that, I mean, remember, you think about the advertisements for the telecast, they do that now. They integrate so much advertising into a telecast now, I don't think they need to do that anymore.
It's still not as bad as football, because if you go to a football game, it is really one of the least fun experiences you can have as a fan.
I've been to one NFL game in, I don't know, 16 years now, since I was at SC and the Raiders played. I actually was at 16-0 game. I think I told you this.
Yeah.
And that's about the only situation where I would go to an NFL game. The following things were in play. Free seats that were very good seats and history could possibly be made.
Mm-hmm.
And NFL, if you turn it into a day-long thing and you get there at 12 and you drink all day, if that's what you're into, and then you go to the game, I guess it's worth it. But the actual experience of attending an NFL game is mind-numbing.
Well, because now they've built all these state-of-the-art stadiums, which have kind of, and when we had Foxborough back in the day, it was kind of this blue-collar crowd and cement seats. I mean, not cement seats, what do you call those, like aluminum rows?
Bleachers.
Yeah, whatever. So we had those. Now it's like, if you go to a football game, you're almost better off being in the luxury box because you got TV and food, and there's so many breaks you can, like, mingle. It's weird. I don't know what's really happened to and the tailgates are always more fun than the actual game, unless it's a great game. But
that's what I think college game's better, because that's as much a part of it as anything else. You're giving up your Saturday and that whole event. Now, of course, as you remember those big games at Holy Cross. Oh, no, wait, never mind.
Yeah, that hurts. Now we don't even have basketball, really. The last couple of years, one of my favorite stats was pitch counts. And the Red Sox were, I think, in my opinion, maybe the Yankees did it first, but one of the first teams that just said, what if we have almost every guy in our order take a lot of pitches? What would happen? Would we bleed every pitcher by the fifth inning? And it was kind of one of the reasons they won last year, just because they were so patient with the plate. This year, the stat that, I'm not as up on this as some people, but the stat that I don't really remember seeing that much, that all of a sudden I was seeing everywhere, was contact rate. And it kept coming up with Frank Thomas. Is that when is this contact rate stat like really gone into the mainstream?
It's not even in the mainstream yet. It's one of the things you look at, though, if you're looking to project a player's performance. Strikeout rate can really drive down. If you look at Ryan Howard now, or worse yet, Jack Cust. You can only strike out so much before you have no way of hitting for a high enough batting average to carry the rest of your game. So if you're striking out 40% of the time, you can't be a good enough hitter to survive. You're not going to do it. So it's important, particularly in an older player, if the strikeout rate goes up, you say, okay, he's having trouble making contact, he's not getting a hot run on the fastball. That can be a sign that, you know, his performance is about to degrade. So it's one of those next level things. Small thing for most players, you know, you kind of say, okay, well, everybody's within a certain range. When you start to look at the outliers, that's where you can get some information.
And, you know, basically the theory is sometimes it just comes down to luck. Like if Frank Thomas is hitting 143, but his contact rate is a little better than you think, maybe he just had bad luck.
Exactly. I mean, when you go back to, I mean, in this, I've been talking about this since Bulldog. Somewhere in there, Costa makes the point about one hit a week, you know, a gork, a ground ball with eyes. Mm-hmm. One hit a week is the difference between 250 and 300. And really, hitters have control on their batting average on balls in play. Pitchers don't. If you hit a ball against a pitcher, it's up to your defense how well they play. Hitters have more control over it. But it's something they have less control over they do their power and their contact rate. So, yeah, you get a lot of these situations where B.J. Upton was a guy last year. I was looking at the start of last year. Remember he was hitting like 420?
Yeah.
But you looked and you saw that he was actually striking out in 40% of his at-bats. He was hitting 6-something when he made contact. And guys don't do that. The best ever, I looked it up, it was like the best guys ever in a season hit like 470 on contact, and typically the leaders are going to be around 420. Like a Ryan Howard won the MVP at 444 on contact because he had to because he struck out 170 times. But generally, if a guy's hitting in the 400s on contact, he's striking out a lot, you can expect his numbers to drop.
I remember one of the two Nomar years when he had the high batting average. He had 357, I think, one year, and 372 the other. I don't remember which one came first. But one of those years, he had really bad luck that season. I remember thinking, like, he could easily be hitting 400 if he had gotten one break per week for, you know, the first 20 weeks or whatever. And I think he was near the 400s for a while. But Nomar, to me, is a classic example of somebody, like, in that two-year stretch, every time he came up, he was hitting a line drive somewhere. And a lot of them just went at somebody. Why can't we come up with some sort of stat like best looking hits? You know what I mean? Like something that places emphasis on the fact that this guy's creaming the ball every time he comes up. Or is that the same thing as contact?
Line drive percentage. I mean, if you
is that a stat?
They actually track it now. Instead of just being ground ball, fly ball, batted ball types get tracked by Major League Baseball, by Baseball Info Solutions. Ground ball, fly ball, pop up, line drive, and you know, non-contact. And you find guys who, and you'll see this all the time. If you go to places where they talk baseball online, it's, you know, yeah, he's only hitting 245, but he's got a line drive percentage of 17%. And if you see a number like that, guys hitting line drives 1/6 of the time, his numbers are going to go back up because it's hitting line drives. Mm. It works the same for pitchers, too. A pitcher who's giving up a lot of line drives but has a low ERA, those two things don't work together. The ERA is likely going to come up. So, yeah, stuff like that gets tracked. It's not pretty a swing, but line drive percentage is a pretty good proxy for that kind of thing.
I didn't know they had the line drive percentage. I knew they had the ratio stats, but I guess that's kind of what I'm looking for. Don't you agree that baseball is the best sport for stats by far?
Yeah, because it's more individual than any other sport. Now, I think that statistical analysis in other sports can bring a lot to the table, but in baseball, because you can tease out the outside factors so much better, and it just comes down to, you know, hitting, pitching, and fielding, and the opportunities you have to do those things. So there's no question that you can break down baseball. And that's why baseball has always been ahead of the curve on this stuff.
Right.
You can isolate individual performances better than you can anywhere else. And I know you and I have gone back about basketball. But
I can't handle basketball.
But, you know, at least if nothing else, opportunity, performance in the context of opportunity is important. And that's the big thing about all baseball statistics. All you're trying to do is measure performance in the context of opportunity. And that's why you want to take out things that are contextual or spoiled by context. That's, you know, the big argument. Things like RBIs, things like wins, things like saves, that are so much about opportunity and less about performance. And that's, you know, we try to get away from those and try to get things that are more about performance.
I'm willing to concede that we might be headed towards the right direction in basketball because now we're seeing more stats like, you know, field goal percentage for wide open jumpers, stuff like that. Now, that's stuff that I think is really helpful because it could tell you, I remember like I was looking at 82games.com. Sorry to mention a competitor.
No, fantastic site. You can link to them all the time.
All right. Mo Williams of the Milwaukee Bucks shooting 51% on wide open jumpers this year. Now, that's a team that doesn't really have a big guy that commands a double team. So what would happen if you put him on a team with somebody like Duncan where he could just shoot those open jumpers. Like now he's pretty effective. I like those kind of stats. I like stats like I wish we kept track of assists that led to fouls because Chris Paul probably five times a game has a great pass where the guy has to get fouled to prevent him from getting a dunk. I think we're headed in that direction with really refined, cool stats that kind of add to what we're watching. I don't buy this stuff like the wages of win garbage. And I think PER has a lot of flaws. Even Hollinger would admit that. The players depend too much on each other to really give them a rating. You know what I mean?
Well, I think that there's a difference between rating stats, things that try to throw everything into one number. And those can be informational, and sometimes those are garbage stats. We have those in baseball too. But if you want to look at the statistical record to figure out things that show you player skills, in other words, we know now that statistically we can find the guys who actually have the best range. You know, mm-hmm. defensively, we can measure how many balls were hit in this area, how many they get. That's applicable to like the Mo Williams example, where it's okay, how many opportunities did he have to shoot this type of shot, and how many did he make? The Chris Paul thing is fantastic because there's value being created that we're not capturing in the regular statistical record.
No.
One of the things that I think is most important is possessions. Looking at things not per game or per minute, but per possessions, because you have a completely different set of opportunities in a Suns game than you would in a typical, Hornets game. Chris Paul's racking up all of these numbers in a lot fewer possessions than, say, Steve Nash gets in a typical game. So
right.
things
and
like that,
like,
I think...
Well, Sean Marion on the Suns, I think his stats were a little skewed because of their style.
Yeah, and that's
put
why...
put him on a normal team, he's not the same guy.
Guys like Hollinger, guys like Kevin Pelton, Bradford Doolittle at Basketball Prospectus, they're saying, okay, let's look at things in the context of possessions, and that kind of teases out some of those problems. One of the things I think is interesting now, we're getting stats on guys late in games. You know, we used to think about guys at baseball stats, late inning pressure situations. You're seeing stats broken down like last 5 minutes of close games. And I think that's actually more indicative than the baseball ones are. Because, you know, sometimes
yeah.
a lot of those baseball performances aren't actually all that meaningful. Guys batting, when you break down baseball stats, you're going to get some noise in there. But if you have the last 5 minutes of close games, and LeBron has some ridiculous shooting percentage in that, that's telling you a lot about his performance in close games.
And that's why I was so worried about the Celtics, because the 82 games, they had that stat, and none of the Celtics had the big three guys. None of them had a good field goal percentage in the final 5 minutes or in the close and tight 2 minutes, where somebody like Ginobili, who is out of his mind this whole year in
yep.
the clutch, and then the stats back it up. He's 62% last 5 minutes and, 59% last 2 minutes. And I love that. And I feel like a couple years from now, when we work out all the kinks, then I'll be convinced that basketball stats are getting somewhere. Right now, I think it relies just too much on the per minute, and the teammates are totally discounted, in terms of somebody's trapped in a bad situation. I just don't think there's any way to effectively evaluate everybody.
But you're finding ways to where there are two things happening here. I mean, the Garchomp example is another one where you see something and then you want to find out more about it. And the way to find out more about it isn't just to talk about it with your buddies or watch more tape. It's to actually then you go to the numbers and say what does the large amount of data. Your observation was one thing. What does the data say about the observation? And sometimes it's going to be conflicting, and sometimes it's going to be supportive, but the data is just more information collected in a systemic manner. And that, to me, has been the big argument for me, for baseball stats for years. It's not that the statistics are different. The statistics just capture all of the information. It shows that, I'm sure if we had data for Domer Garchomp's line drive percentage in 97-98, 98-99, whatever the year, you had 370 throw in there. It would have been phenomenal. And that's where, like I say, basketball is the same thing. You're just collecting data and seeing where the data takes you. Sometimes you're going to be surprised and sometimes going to support things.
What's it saying about Jeter's defense?
It's still not that good. Mm. And here's the thing. Here's what drives me nuts about this, Bill. If you watch Derek Jeter play, you can see exactly what he does well and exactly what he doesn't do well. But he's like the emperor with no clothes out there. Nobody talks about the things he doesn't do well. Derek Jeter goes to his right, has a very strong arm, and is phenomenal on balls in the air. Derek Jeter doesn't go to his left very well. He has never gone to his left very well. You can see it in the footwork. You can see it when a ball is hit and just how many balls get by him to his left. And the numbers have borne that out for years. He had a couple of years where he was averaged slightly above, and he's had a number of years where he's been terrible.
Hmm.
But Derek Jeter's defensive numbers support what any neutral observer is going to say just looking at him. He does some things well, he does some things poorly, and the things he does poorly, go to his left, tend to carry more weight to performance at shortstop.
Here's my last question. Do you think the stats have gotten too good to the point that it's impossible for people to just have arguments about baseball because in every possible argument you could just bring up the stat to contradict the other guy's point, and you can't just say something blindly like, Jake Jeter's clutch.
No, I love it. That everybody's got to bring information. It can't just be about, you know, well, this is the whole thing, well, that's just your opinion. You got to bring information. This goes.
But is that a good thing, though?
I think it's absolutely a good thing. I think it's absolutely a good thing. We should not. It shouldn't be a situation where you just because you feel something or believe something that's a complete contradiction to the data, you should just get to do it anyway. I mean, that's what politics is for. You should actually have to bring information to any argument. And I think the fact that there's all this information out there makes it great. Don't get me wrong, Bill. I think if you want to be a baseball fan, just wants to go to the park, enjoy the game, have a beer, kick back, I'm never going to take that away from you. If you want to say that your favorite player is Garrett Anderson, that's not something I'll ever argue with you.
But you I thought you'd feel sorry for the person.
No, not even, not at all, not in any way, shape, or form. This is the whole thing. People think going to the games with, like, baseball prospectus guys, we sit there with laptops and slide rules or something.
You don't?
Man, we just like to kick back and watch a game. We love baseball. But there's nothing wrong with loving baseball however you care to. But it's when you start to make an argument that player X is better than player Y that you say, okay, well, now we're getting into comparisons. That's where you got to bring the data. That's where you got to bring the information. So it's not if you want to have favorites, if you want to enjoy the game on any number of levels, go for it.
So when I say Hideki Okajima makes me nervous this year, and he didn't make me nervous last year,
then
I look up the stats, and the stats are really good, except for there's one stat about something like batting average with guy inherited runners or whatever, and he's terrible in that one category. But everything else is kind of the same. But then you have to look up that one stat, and it's like, oh yeah, actually he's a lot of guys he's inheriting score. So we didn't have that 20 years ago.
No. Now we have all this additional information. We can say, I can go out and say, gee, why aren't the Brewers hitting at all? Well, it's not because the Brewers are unclutch or bad. It's because they've got a whole bunch of guys who can't hit right-handed pitching. I wouldn't have known that 20 years ago.
All right, I have one more last question. I know I already asked the last question.
Go ahead.
Your prediction for the next stat that nobody's heard of yet that will become a major player?
I would say the breakdown on balls in play. Ground ball, line drive. I think line drive percentage is going to be the kind of thing that people start talking about in terms of breaking down hitters. Things that happen on batted balls that aren't outcome related, ground balls, fly balls, line drives, things like that, that's going to be the big thing for pitchers and hitters.
And do you have that on your site?
We don't have line drive percentage. I know you can get it from places like the Hardball Times.
All right. All right, you're coming back later in this season. We didn't talk enough about this season, but I love the stats.
We didn't talk any Yankees-Red Sox, which surprised me.
Well, there's not much to talk about. The Red Sox had the Japan trip, and you knew they were going to have a mediocre April, and now we have the easy schedule coming up. We'll be fine. I use we like I'm on the team.
I know.
And the Yanks, they, you know, I'm sure Dale Rasner's going to go 12-0. I mean, I have no doubt in my mind.
He's the Aaron Small of 2008.
Of course he is. I mean, there's no doubt. You know, they had your typical... They let everybody got freaked out. They did bad. Oh my God, we're going to be terrible. All the Yankee fans want cat. I'm sure they're going to win 15 in their next 16, and Darryl Rasner will win the Cy Young. So I think it's going to be the two of them again, and you have those 4.5 hour games to look forward to in September.
All October. Yep.
Yeah. All right. We'll have you on again, Joe Sheehan, Baseball Prospectus. Thanks for coming up.
Thanks, Bill. Take care.
All right.
Target to set off. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.